to the book of 2 Kings in chapter 2. 2 Kings chapter 2 is where we're going to be starting together in just a few moments. Of course, we want to once again welcome everyone who's able to join us for worship this morning. Of course, we have those who are still recuperating and sick and several who are traveling. But we're thankful for everyone who can be with us this morning. That's especially true if you're visiting with us. We appreciate you taking the time to be here. Hope that our services can be edifying for you and that you will have safety as you go back to your homes. If you're still here, we invite you to come back this afternoon. We'll be worshiping together again at 4 o'clock. We'll be finishing up our study through the book of Ephesians, picking up in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 5 this evening. For this morning, we're going to be looking at the book of 2 Kings, particularly a story about the prophet Elisha jumping around in chapters 2 through 4. We're doing this to coincide with our Bible reading plan for the year. I'll just take this moment to remind you of that, and I hope that you're following along and benefiting from that. If you're like me, I know that at this point in the year, you probably decided or dedicated yourself to do some things at the start that you've fallen off the rails on. And if this reading plan is one of them, that's okay. You've got plenty of time to catch up. If you've already read through it once and you're starting on it again, that's even better. It doesn't take all that long to go through, and so I would encourage you to take part in that with us as we're doing these lessons and the occasional articles. But we want to establish a little bit of context for what we're looking at as we are sort of jumping right into a passage this morning. The period of Elisha's life takes place in what we commonly call the divided kingdom, a period where the nation of Israel, for various reasons of unfaithfulness, has been split into two parts, the nation of Israel to the north and the nation of Judah to the south. And during this time, it's really true for the period as a whole, but during this time, we've got a time of transition. Elijah has been the prophet on the scene for quite some time, and he's going to be moving off of the scene. Ahab has been king in Israel, and he's being taken off the scene. And so all sorts of power moves are going on, even in other countries like Syria. New kings are coming to the stage. And one observation that we'll see is that while the quality and character of these various new kings that come on the scene may vary quite a bit, the quality and character of God's prophets stays the same. These are quality men, quality servants that we're dealing with. I think one of the challenges in reading through these historical accounts is to ask the question, how do these things apply to me? Of course, they're encouraging and they add to my knowledge, but how can I take what I'm reading about here with God's servant and take something away from that that I can apply in my life? We've mentioned before, I think even in conjunction with this reading plan, the old tried and true Bible method of study. When you come to any passage, you can just ask a series of questions. Is there a command in this passage for me to follow? Is there a sin that I need to avoid? Is there a promise that God's going to fulfill at some time or a prayer that I could make my own? And perhaps most often we can ask the question, if there's nothing else, is there an example that I can follow? And I think above all, while these passages certainly are going to contain a little bit of all of that, this is an excellent passage to ask the question, how can I make this example my own? And that's largely what we're going to be doing in our study this morning as we look at Elisha's life. Because Elisha, I think especially in this period of transition, gives us a wonderful picture of what it looks like when someone is willing and dedicated and ready to serve God with all of their heart. And so while Elisha is introduced to us in the book of 1 Kings in chapter 19, we're going to be picking up in 2 Kings chapter 2. We want to establish a little bit of context for that as well. Elijah has been preparing Elisha to take his place. Earlier in 1 Kings 19, Elijah had experienced some difficulty at the hands of the threats that were coming from Jezebel, and he reacted to those things with extreme doubt. Now, God still had some ways he was going to use Elijah, but after Elijah expressed such doubt, God put in motion plans to remove Elijah from the scene and install in his place his successor in the form of Elisha. And so that's what's been going on for several chapters. Elisha has been being trained. He has been having Elijah as a mentor. And in the text we're about to read, Elijah is going to give Elisha three opportunities to turn around and leave. Three opportunities to turn back and maybe go back to his old way of life. I don't know that it's clear in the text if he's saying you don't have to witness what's about to happen, or if he's saying now's your chance to just sort of turn around and walk away from this life altogether. It very well could be both. But either way, it seems that this is a clear test of Elisha's dedication to Elijah, and by extension, the dedication that he would be showing to the Lord. Let's read starting in 2 Kings chapter 2 and verse 1. We're going to jump around just a little bit. But it came about in verse 1 when the Lord was about to take up Elijah by a whirlwind to heaven, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. And then in verse 4, Elijah said to him, "Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho." But he said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they came to Jericho. And then in verse 6, then Elijah said to him, "Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan." And he said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. Elisha says, I don't care if you're going to Bethel. I don't care if you're going to Jericho. I don't care if you're going to the Jordan. You're not going without me. It might seem to be an obvious choice to us as readers. Well, of course he's going to go along with Elijah. But consider that the temptation to walk away from all of that would have been very great. Prophets are not exactly known for their lives of luxury, are they? Prophets are not exactly known for the warm receptions that they receive and being welcomed by all of the elite. When we first see Elijah calling Elisha in 1 Kings 19, when he places his cloak on him and says, "You're coming with me," Elisha says, let me go back and kiss my father and my mother. And if we're reading that and we're thinking about the parable that Jesus, the account where Jesus is requested to let me go back and bury my father, we might expect Elijah to say, "Nope, you're coming with me. This is it." But that's not what Elijah responds. He says, "Go back then, for what have I done to you?" When he was called, Elijah knew what he was doing to Elisha. He was calling him to a life of hardship, a life of service, and really a life of rejection. Elisha's life was no longer going to be easy. It certainly wasn't going to be simple, and his life no longer would be his. Add to this the difficulty of seeing your mentor is going to be taken away from you. How might we choose? Well, I've already done enough. I've been with you quite some time. You know, my obligation is fulfilled. Why continue? Or I've already got enough suffering ahead of me if I'm going to keep on doing this prophet thing. Why should I add to all of that this terribly emotional experience? What choice do people often make today when they're given the opportunity to give up, given the opportunity to turn back. But Elisha was unwilling to leave the side of Elijah even for a moment. He would stay with him to the end, showing his dedication to Elijah and by extension to the Lord that they both served. Elisha's determination to persevere through that difficulty was foundational to the service that he offered to God. And that is certainly an attitude, that type of grit and determination. That's something that I can work harder to model in my service to the Lord. But let's go back to our text for a moment and pick up reading this time in verse 3. These events are taking place again on the way. But in verse 3, the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today?" And he said, "Yes, I know. Be still." Then in verse 5, the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho approached Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that the Lord will take away your master from over you today?" He answered, "Yes, I know. Be still." Even after Elijah is taken in verse 15, when the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho opposite him saw him, they said, "The spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha," and they came to meet him and bowed themselves to the ground before him. They said to him, "Behold now, there are with your servants 50 strong men. Please let them go and search for your master. Perhaps the spirit of the Lord has taken him up and cast him on some mountain or into some valley." Now Elisha says there's no point in looking, but they persist until he allows them to go. You know, in a way, these verses are almost comical to me. I think that we can sympathize with the sort of panic and fear of the sons of the prophets. I mean, after all, Elijah being taken away is a pretty big deal. But do you sense in the requests that they're almost asking Elisha, "How can you be so calm at a time like this? Don't you know? God's taking Elijah away. Don't you know? You're not going to have your master anymore after today." Yes, I know. Be still. Even after all of that, it's as though they just can't accept. This hasn't really happened. God couldn't take Elijah away. The Spirit has just taken him and, you know, dropped him off on some mountain somewhere. And if we've got enough strong men, we should be able to go out and we can find him. We've got 50. In terms of both the content of those two words and their simplicity, that is a great expression of trust. Yes, I know. I know he's going to be taken away. I know I'm not going to have my master anymore, but it'll be okay. Be still. Now again, I can ask myself, who do I most often identify with? The spirit of Elisha that says, "Yes, I know. Be still." Or the spirit of the sons of the prophets that says, "Everybody panic! It's all going to go haywire. Everything's going to roll out of control. Something's happening and we're just not going to be able to fix it." Well, again, I think like the prophets, I sometimes have trouble accepting the reality that's in front of me and coming to grips with it and being okay with it. But when I remember, as Elisha does, regardless of what's unfolding in front of me, that God is still in control, then I can model that behavior. Yes, I know. Be still. One of the sad doesn't quite seem to cut it, but one of the most difficult stories for me in the divided kingdom is one that we haven't yet come to. It's the story of Joash and Jehoiada. The story of Joash is the story of someone who was rescued as a child while all of his brothers were being murdered. But the faithful priest, Jehoiada, saved him. And he raises him. He trains him in godliness. He mentors him. In the text, when you get to about 1 Kings 12 and further on in 2 Chronicles 24, says that this king Joash, he was faithful. And he did a lot of good works. And he instituted a lot of reforms. But then Jehoiada dies. And in 2 Chronicles 24 and in verse 17, it says that the rulers of Judah came and approached the king, and he listened to them. Joash was a good king as long as he had that spiritual force for good in his presence. But the moment that force left, he goes off the rails. He even goes so far as to murder the own son of his mentor. That's how far in the opposite direction he goes. He was a good king as long as he had someone there to make him be a good king. Something that stands out strongly in the story of Elisha is that Elisha's faithfulness was not dependent on the presence of his mentor Elijah. It lived long after Elijah had gone on, up to the point of his death. This may not play out today in as a dramatic a fashion as it did with Joash and Jehoiada. But how often do we see those same principles being borne out? Let me put it this way. How often do we see children who grow up in homes with godly fathers and mothers, godly influences, but the moment that they leave home, and they're away from that influence, they decide to be wicked. Or they have a strong parent, but then the parent dies, and now they're wicked. How often do we have a spouse who was faithful as long as their spiritually minded partner was still with them, and then the spouse dies and their service goes away? What about a congregation who is faithfully fighting for the word as long as one strong elder is still living or a certain preacher is present, but the leadership dies or the preacher moves away and then the congregation goes off the rails? Or how often do we see ministers of God's word who are rightly dividing up until the point that they're strong godly influences are taken away? Of course, the answer to all of those is far, far too often. Any instance would be far too often. Again, as with Elisha, this wasn't going to take place. I think one of the clearest demonstrations of that comes in chapter 3. You know, we mentioned a moment ago that new kings are coming on the scene. Well, now there's a new king. And I wonder if that king thought, well, now we can bury the past. You know, my father and Elijah, they butted heads all the time, and there was all this friction between them, but now I'm the king, and there's a new prophet in town. Maybe things will be different. In chapter 3, the king of Israel has once again roped in the king of Judah to go off on some escapade, and they are on the point of death. When in chapter 3, verse 11, Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, says, "Is there not a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of the Lord by him?" And one of the king of Israel's servants answered and said, "Elisha, the son of Shaphat, is here, who used to pour water on the hands of Elijah." Jehoshaphat said, "The word of the Lord is with him." So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down to him. Now Elisha said to the king of Israel, "What do I have to do with you? Go to the prophets of your father and to the prophets of your mother. And the king of Israel said to him, No, for the Lord has called these three kings together to give them into the hand of Moab. Elisha said, As the Lord of hosts lives before whom I stand, were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look at you nor see you. Well, isn't that a fine how do you do? There was not going to be any change between Elijah and Elisha when it came to interacting with wicked kings who rebelled against God and persecuted his prophets. But others might say, well, you've got a fresh start here. Why would you make it so hard on yourself? You don't have to be so rude about it. You could make friends with him instead of making him your enemy. Elisha was no more impressed with this wicked king than Elijah had been with his father. And to me, early on in his life, that is one of the clearest demonstrations of Elisha's continued faithfulness, even without the presence of his mentor. But if we can go back to chapter 2 for a moment, there are a lot of differences between Elisha and Elijah. We might even say, in some regard, there are improvements between the two. We mentioned at the beginning that Elijah was taken off the scene because of the doubt that he expressed when he was responding to the difficulty he faced. We see not even a trace of that in the life of Elisha. Look at 2 Kings chapter 2. And verse 11. As they were going there, or as they were going along and talking, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire which separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind to heaven. Elisha saw it and cried out, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And he saw Elijah no more. Then he took hold of his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. He also took up the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and returned and stood by the bank of the Jordan. He took the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and struck the waters and said, Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah? And when he also had struck the waters, they were divided here and there, and Elisha crossed over. Let me emphasize that Elisha's statement in verse 14 is not a statement of, All right, God, are you there? I'm not sure if you're around anymore. It is a statement of confidence because he is calling on God to act for him in the same way that he had acted for Elijah on the way across. Now, think about the difference there. Elijah, yes, he had discouragement when Jezebel was threatening his life. But like others, he saw that discouragement and he responded to it with doubt. I can't go on. What's the point of going on? Perhaps it's not a one-to-one in comparison of what they experienced. I can't imagine seeing my loved one taken up into the sky in chariots of fire either. But he's obviously distraught over it. Enough to tear his own clothes in response as he has lost his mentor. And yet, he picks up the cloak, calls on God to act with confidence, parts the waters. Elisha was ready to get to work. There was no doubt about whether or not God was with him. Again, I can pose the question as to which of those two figures I most easily relate to, and I know that I need to work harder in being like Elisha in this regard. But in reference to the work that he was ready to do, let's look back at 2 Kings chapter 2 and read verses 9 and 10. When they had crossed over, Elijah said to Elisha, Ask what I shall do for you before I am taken from you. And Elisha said, Please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me. He said, You have asked a hard thing. Nonetheless, if you see me when I am being taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so." Now, understand that Elisha is not literally saying, I want twice as much power as Elijah. But I think most likely what he's asking for, the idea of a double portion, is the inheritance of a firstborn son. Give me the proof that I am your heir, that the double portion is going to be given to me. Now, having said that, I will point out that there are recorded 5 miracles of Elijah, and there are recorded 12 miracles of Elisha. Elisha, in terms of numbers, certainly did more miraculous things by the Spirit of God than Elijah did. But this isn't just a comparison of numbers. What I want us to emphasize is what this demonstrates, and that is that Elisha did not squander the thing that had been given to him by God in this context. It would be hard to imagine, but try and think, if Elisha had made this request, I want the double portion of the Spirit that rested on you, and then God granted that request and he just didn't do anything with it. What if he had been like Solomon, who prayed for wisdom and God answered and gave it to him, only to then squander it all away, and in the end use it for nothing? These first few chapters, especially chapter 4, once he gets going, it's just one miracle right after the other. And it's as if the text is laid out in such a way to show us, yes, Elisha received the double portion and he got busy putting it to work. Elisha begs for the ability to work for the Lord. And his life is a record of someone who worked all the way up to the point of their death, literally doing God's work. Elisha is going to be on his deathbed, and he's still going to be prophesying to people. You know, we could get really technical and say Elisha's still working even after he's dead. His bones are raising people from the dead. I look at his example, and I have to ask myself if I am fully using what I've been given in the service of the Lord. Have I prayed for some sort of blessing of a physical nature? Are there possessions that I have? Am I using those things to serve others? Am I putting them out for the glory of God? What about knowledge that I've been given by others? Have I grown up with good Bible teachers and those who are instilling in me a love for the Lord? Am I putting that to use? Has God blessed me, or has he blessed you with a mind that can learn and teach others what's in his Word? What am I doing with it? Whatever the double portion that God has given me, how am I putting it to use? How does it compare to the work ethic and the attitude of Elisha? Speaking for me, I think I have a long way to go, but I have an example set before me. Let's make just a couple of observations as we draw this study to a close. I want to take these and just make a couple of observations about the big picture of what's going on here. It would have been enough if the only prophet that God had sent to Israel had been Elijah. Elijah was impressive by any definition. He was a presence. And yet God saw fit, even after Israel did not respond to Elijah, he wasn't ready to give up on them yet. And what he did leaves them without excuse, because he says, if you thought Elijah was impressive, wait till you see Elisha. You know, it's bigger, it's better, it's version 2.0. It's improved in every way. If Elijah left them without an excuse, Elisha left them doubly so. God had a messenger in Elisha who worked so hard that no one could possibly say, well, God, you didn't do enough. You didn't make your presence known. You didn't tell us what was expected of you. They had everything and more in that messenger. And as we look at this passage to ask the question of how can we be more like Elisha, I would hope that we could have that be said of us as well. Of course, we want others to repent. That is our goal. But in the end, can it be said of us that those who didn't repent, our friends, our neighbors, our loved ones, are without excuse? Are we acting in the nature of Elisha in terms of our quality and quantity of service that we are working for the Lord, that it could be said that our neighbors know what God expects of them, that they have seen God's will modeled in our lives? Or am I falling short in such a wonderful example of a servant of God? I hope that these thoughts are helpful for you as we consider these things together. And that's really the admonition that I want us to walk away from. Taking the picture that Elisha gives us, putting these and other characteristics into work in our service to improve and be the best possible messengers of the Lord that we can be as we work in God's kingdom here. But now, as we get ready to sing together a song, means of invitation, we offer the chance for each of us to make that commitment this morning that our lives are going to be lived in the service of the Lord. Living for Jesus begins by responding to the gospel, acknowledging and submitting to His Lordship, being baptized with Him, the grave of baptism, raised up a new creature. If you haven't done that, you have the opportunity today. And if you have, and you find that your service is lacking, that it needs renewal, and you want prayers for your faith, we would be glad to offer them. If we can encourage you in a spiritual way, we'd ask that you come while we stand and sing together.